This teleclass introduction has been re-recorded. Hello and welcome to the Graphic Artists Guild Professional Teleclass Series. This teleclass, titled The Client Wishlist, The Beautiful Proposal, and The Project Scope, is presented by Daniel Shudsmith.
I'm doing a bunch of other presentations this summer as well, so if you see me in your area, feel free to stop by or just email me and maybe get together and you can ask me some more questions or whatever you want to. So a little bit about me and how I got into this whole thing is I actually started as a web designer back in 98. I actually started right out of college and got laid off because of the dot-com bust basically in 2000. And so what happened for me really at a very early start in my career is I realized that I kind of had to know more about the entire business side of what goes on, no matter what industry I wanted to end up in. But I just realized, you know, the people that were doing the layoffs and the people that were deciding who stays and who goes were, you know, the people who were also running the business, who understood all those dynamics and all the things about, you know, finding the right clients and profit margin and all of those different nuances. So what ended up happening was after I got laid off, I realized that I needed to focus on this, and so I started learning more about project management and then eventually stumbled into business management. And all of that was purely by, you know, just taking on more projects than I could basically handle at the time and just kind of teaching myself this stuff trial by fire in a way, which I wouldn't actually recommend too often, but it does work rather well to do a lot of things in trial by fire, just to make sure that you can actually own up to it and kind of become aware that you are capable of achieving these things. So I ended up moving to New York City and worked for a host of different design shops, and I never actually stayed in any one place too long because I wanted to also see kind of the different characteristics of these different design shops and kind of, you know, what made them tick, what made them successful, what made them fail in certain aspects, you know, what did people on staff like, what did the clients like, you know, all those different types of things. I really tried to absorb really as much as I could really at the onset of coming to New York City. So I ended up at a design studio called Chopping Block. And Chopping Block did a few different websites back in the day of like Fish the Band, They Might Be Giants, Dave Matthews Band, a lot of different, you know, entertainment sites and things like that. And what I started to realize right away was that, you know, these guys weren't necessarily business guys. You know, they were designers that ended up, you know, having their own studio. Basically, they, you know, had a dream of doing work for clients that they wanted to do work for, and, you know, they couldn't tell a balance sheet from, you know, any other piece of paper that was on their desk. So what ended up happening was I kind of absorbed a lot of the ways that they dealt with business right from the beginning, which, you know, was good and was also a little bit cumbersome at times. But the key thing was, you know, they essentially showed me kind of like the hacks that they used, you know, the little kind of tricks to the methodologies of business that, you know, any MBA would tell you, you know, these guys were doing that, but they were just kind of modifying it a little bit to make it easier as a creative to do that thing or to, you know, to be able to handle that task. So a lot of the things that I'm going to show you today actually, you know, sprout all the way back from that period even of my life, which is about, you know, 2001 to 2005, somewhere there. I'm also a professor at the School of Visual Arts here in New York City. I teach the Business of Studio course, and this is pretty relevant to today's call as well, because you may have noticed even on one of the worksheets that I gave you, I think it was the client wish list one, it actually even says Business of Studio at the top there. So you're actually getting some of the same materials that I hand out to my students for that class. The only difference is that, you know, the class that I teach there, SVA, it's about 12 weeks long and about 4 hours a week. And the funny thing is that even then, there really isn't enough time to cover everything that you know, we'd want to cover about the whole topics of business, everything from project management to proposals to client relations and back again. Throughout the time of teaching SVA and also being at Chopping Block and then other design studios, I also realized that I kind of wanted to help the industry and kind of let the industry know about, you know, kind of what I learned along the way. You know, I started realizing real quickly that, you know, the things that I was learning and that I was kind of picking up and that I was, you know, making notes to myself about weren't necessarily, you know, something that most of us were sharing. You know, it seems like when we talk about business, I mean, whether it's in our industry or in any other industry, you know, the business guys are the ones that try to keep everything kind of secret. You know, if they find a secret to success, they try to keep it close to their chest. They don't necessarily want, you know, God forbid, they don't want their competition to know, you know, what they did to achieve that success. And what, you know, what I always thought, because of course I came from a family that believed in a society that we could share everything. So what I always thought that was whatever I was learning, even if it was, you know, something really important, something about business, I should be sharing it with, you know, my peers and my colleagues that were out there. And so what I started to do is I started to ask other folks that I knew that I was also learning from, other, you know, friends and people I met at conferences, to also share, like, what they were talking about as well. And I started an e-zine back in 2006, and I regretfully haven't updated it for a while. I think probably about a year and a half to 2 years. But we are updating it with more materials and more articles. The e-zine is graphicdefine.org. That's graphicdefine.org. And it just has some great articles, much on kind of the same things we're going to talk to you about today, but even more focused on, you know, small, minute details of what we deal with every day on the business side of things as creatives. You know, so everything from, you know, how do you handle someone saying no to you, you know, and dealing with that, or, you know, how do you kind of determine what your real product is? You know, how do you know exactly what you are selling, you know, at the end of the day? And those are actually all really relevant things that you could always ask me, and I'd be able to help you figure that out. So, you know, through the years, I mean, the thing I'm just trying to show you is that, you know, this is something that's kind of near and dear to my heart, but I also understand that I don't know everything. So, you know, I definitely welcome any tips or tricks or things like that you guys might have as well. I've actually learned some awesome methodologies about project management from my students at the School of Visual Arts. Just 2 years ago, we did a big project management study, and basically the students just kind of floored me as to how much information they were able to figure out and to share with everybody. So definitely, you know, always feel free to let me know, you know, what you guys think as well. So some of the, you know, specific things I'm doing now, I mean, in the past few years, I've basically been a business manager on a contractual basis for a few different firms. So recently I was at Barbarian Group, which, you know, I say the name Barbarian Group and everyone thinks that they were mercenaries, but they really weren't. They were actually the folks that you might have seen the website back a few years ago for Burger King, where a guy dressed up in a chicken suit, and then you could tell him to do whatever you wanted him to do. You could tell him to, you know, build a fort, or you can tell him to, you know, run, or whatever it was. And basically, Barbarian Group were the folks that came up with that kind of stuff. Since then, I've actually moved on to actually a rather permanent position with an old friend of mine at a place called Core Industries. And at Core, we're focusing on green and sustainability marketing. So it's actually only working with clients that are green and sustainable focused. And whether that's larger corporations that are deciding to now play nice, or whether that's actual organizations like Live Earth or Rainforest Alliance or things like that. So I'm still very much doing business management. I'm still very much teaching. And a lot of the stuff that I'm going to show you are actually things that I do use on a regular basis. For instance, we'll take a look at the quality triangle today, and that's actually something I use every time I'm on the phone with a new client. We'll also take a look at the client wish list, and that's something I've enacted at every single place that I've ever worked at. And it really works well. It really does. So let's start with the client wish list worksheet. Now, one of the key things that I noticed right away, at, you know, several of those studios that I've visited was that there always seems to be kind of an earnest of, you know, we want to work with specific clients, but we don't know how to get them. Or we're not sure who we want to work with, but we just know we're not working with the right people. You know, I think a lot of times what ends up happening is we get kind of caught up on, we get caught up on the dollar, or we get caught up on just kind of like the repetition or the familiarity of, you know, working with certain clients or on certain projects or whatever the case may be. But what I've actually found is that if you go ahead and, you know, kind of set your sights on exactly who you want to be working with, you're just going to kind of be guaranteeing and giving yourself a much better chance at working with those folks someday. And I've even worked with, you know, some studios that have kind of looked at this and, you know, you look at their list and you say, my gosh, you know, this is a you know, an illustrator in kind of a regional, you know, place in Missouri. You're not sure that they're actually going to be able to get the clients that they're saying they want to get and stuff like that. But lo and behold, they're able to find exactly those clients. And it's interesting how just kind of, you know, putting this stuff down, taking a look at it, kind of setting your sights on exactly who you want to work with helps you find and kind of like get those steps to achieve that, to actually get your foot in the door and make a connection with the right people and then be able to actually close the deal with that company. So for the client wish list, originally it was just a long laundry list of clients that someone would want to work with. And then what I started to realize is that, you know, it really is a process to it, to having a client wish list and figuring out how you're going to get those clients. So the first thing I would say is to write down the top three industries that you would like to work with. Now, obviously, you could say, you know, the top five, or you could say the top 10 industries you want to work with. The reason we say three is really just to, you know, not bite off more than you can chew right now. Just focusing on three, you know, look at those ones first, and then, you know, you can broaden your scopes from there. So write down the top three industries you would like to work with. And usually, you know, these industries can be anything from, you know, entertainment to pharmaceutical. Believe it or not, people do like to work with pharmaceuticals, you know, to green, to whatever, you know, really you think that you would like to be working with. The other thing I'll point out, too, is that, you know, to take this into perspective of yourself as a freelancer, you know, this is rather easy to fill out because you don't necessarily have other people to ask, you know, what industries do we want to work with or anything like that. But if you maybe have a small studio or, you know, a smaller agency, I would actually pose the question to all the folks that you want input from. So if you wanted the whole company to kind of give you feedback on that, then, you know, send an email out to the whole company asking them, kind of, you know, what are the top three industries that everyone wants to work with. What I would suggest kind of is that what I've seen is if you have people reply directly to you and not do a reply all on those kinds of circumstances, you'll get much better feedback because usually when people do reply all, you know, two things can happen. They'll be a little bit afraid to say who exactly they'd want to work with, or they might just, you know, go with everyone else and they're not really telling you what their passion is or who they really want to be working with. So starting out with the top three industries you'd like to work with. And then we take a look at defining the characteristics, the kinds of clients that you'd actually like to work with inside of those industries. And what I mean by characteristics is they could be demographic characteristics. You could say, you know, you wanted them to be clients that, you know, have a regional reach with their products, or maybe you want to go for, you know, national clients, or they could be characteristics based on the actual departmental makeup or, you know, staff makeup of the organization. So, you know, do you want to work with a place where you can get into one department and then basically work with a whole bunch of other departments inside of there? That's actually, you know, if you want to work with educational institutions, that's something that always happens. You know, you get to work with one department in an educational institution, and then that one department ends up telling another department, and then that's how you keep getting more and more business inside of that company or inside of that school. You know, and also characteristics of the way they work. You know, do you want to basically have longer project engagements? Like, should it be a project that you work on for, you know, 2 months or 3 months or whatever the case may be? Or is it something that, you know, you just want to get a project, get your money, do it over a weekend, and by Monday you're all done and you know, you shake hands and everything's good and you move on to the next thing. And which, believe it or not, if quick projects are what you're looking for, you know, in New York, that's where we've always seen ad agencies kind of help with that type of thing. Whether it's for illustrators or whether it's for designers, ad agencies, marketing agencies, it always seems that they never have enough time to actually call us ahead of time to work with them. So we're getting the call at the last minute. But the good thing is you also get paid quickly, and the project is, you know, inevitably done quickly, so you can move on to the next thing. So writing down those characteristics is another important thing. And what that's going to help you do is it's going to help you define, well, who are these actual people? You know, what does this organization look like that I want to be working with? I'd even, you know, go so far as to write down kind of, you know, the how would I put it? I guess emotional characteristics. And that's, you know, are these going to be people you want to work with that, you know, are all about having fun? You know, is it all about, you know, working really, really hard on a project and then you just, you know, laying back and hanging out for like a week together or something? Or is it more of, you know, you want to work with very, very serious, you know, business-oriented, goal-oriented folks? And not to say that the two aren't, you know, one and the same, but, you know, just define those things for yourself. Overall, what I would say is for these characteristics, the smartest piece of advice is just to be truthful with yourself. You know, if you aren't a very punctual person, or if you really don't get excited too much about working with large corporations, then be honest with yourself. Because at the end of the day, you know, if you start bringing in work that basically you don't like, yeah, the money will be there in the interim. But in the long run, you're going to see things go downhill, whether they be projects that you basically took on that, you know, you wholeheartedly regret, or whether it's 5 years from now and you look back and you say, gosh, that was, you know, a waste of my time, or, you know, waste of my life type of scenario, which I think happens a lot in our creative industries. There's actually a constant conversation that goes on with people that I meet at conferences. And there's two topics that they always ask me about. One is the economy, you know, just because we're in such dire straits right now, you know, everyone wants to know kind of what they can do to pick up business. But two, the one that always surprises me is creative burnout, you know, almost every time. And I find it interesting that the creative burnout always comes right after the question about the economy. And so, you know, I really think those kind of go hand in hand of money and, you know, your livelihood. The thing about creativity and about what we do is we all got into this because we liked it. You know, there's no one that gets into design or illustration or something like that and says, I'm going to be a rock star, I'm going to be a millionaire. You know, we get into it because there's some type of thing we have to fulfill. We feel it inside of ourselves, like there's some need that we're trying to get out, and we like, you know, working with clients and fixing, solving problems and doing all that. So it is very important to kind of be aware of the creative burnout that also happens in there. So once we have the characteristics of the industry, of the type of company, and we have the industries we want to work with, then we look at choosing one of those industries and writing down 10 prospective clients that fit within the characteristic description that we've put together. So, for example, when I was at Chopping Block, I know we did this very exercise. And what we decided to do was we wanted to focus on entertainment. That was specific. And we wanted to focus on a couple things. One characteristic was we wanted to focus on some larger headlining acts, big bands, basically, bands that were popular and such. But we also wanted to focus on working with people that, you know, it didn't feel like a giant record label. It didn't feel like you were working with a Sony or BMG or something. We wanted to make sure that we worked with folks that it felt like, you know, they were just, you know, a couple of friends that you went to college with, or people that, you know, you just kind of know, you know, they lived down the road from you or whatever in the country type of thing. And what we ended up doing is we went through this very type of exercise, and one of the clients that we wrote down there was Dave Matthews Band, along with a whole host of other people. And, you know, that's exactly what happened is that, you know, after a certain point, what we started realizing was that we actually could get close to Dave Matthews Band, and we actually could find that connection to come in and be able to work with them at the end of the day. So once you have your 10 prospective clients here, and I'll tell you more about the how we found Dave Matthews Band in a second. Once we have their 10 prospective clients, then we go ahead and look at, you know, what are the steps to be able to make the contact with that specific client. So right away, you know, the funny thing is that this is kind of the part that we always dread. So the last page of the client wish list here. It's always the part where, you know, we actually have to go out and we have to talk to that client. You always have one way to basically start this off, and that's always a cold call. And, you know, everyone kind of dreads cold calls. I don't know anyone that really likes to do it. But we've all been there. That's the thing. You know, cold calls, you know, networking at events, all those things are all, you know, circumstances that no one really likes to do. But, you know, sometimes it is necessary just to get your foot in the door or even just to make kind of that contact point where it's not so much about closing the deal on your first call to them. It's just about knowing, it's just about you making it known to them that you exist. You know, and that's really all it's about. You know, it's not so much that you're trying to get them to sign a contract right then. It's really just getting them to know that you're alive and that you're, you know, looking at them to work with. So cold call is one way. Another thing I would suggest, and this is how we actually got Dave Matthews Band, was look at your current clients and also look at your friends, because chances are the types of companies that you've chosen to go after in your client wish list are also companies that you might have friends of friends working at, or your client may have met, you know, a contact at that company before, or, you know, you may actually have a friend who used to work there, and you never knew that they worked there before. So one of the things I kind of always do when I'm looking for someone specifically to make contact with off my client wish list is I email, I kind of do it in spurts, so I'll email about 10 to 20 people at a time. I won't just go through my entire address book. I'll just do spurts of 10 to 20 people, and I just email them and say, hey, you know, I haven't talked to you in a while, or, you know, I bring up something that we've talked about before. And basically say, hey, by the way, do you know anyone over at, you know, Dave Matthews Band? And the funny thing is that, you know, if you keep going through this, eventually you'll find someone that knows someone. There's always, you know, someone that has a connection to someone else. And right there, you know, that's kind of, you know, one entry point for you. You know, even if it's someone that's kind of, you know, not exactly the decision maker, not the person you want to be talking to, the key thing is that someone in that organization. And that's a huge, huge advantage at the end of the day. The other thing I would say to being able to contact someone off this wish list is actually look for the person on something like LinkedIn. Now, LinkedIn, it's linkedin.com, LinkedIn.com. LinkedIn is a social network purely based on business. So it's not like Facebook where, you know, you're seeing your friends drunk or anything like that. It's not like MySpace that's all about dating or something, or, you know, watching rock bands. LinkedIn is specifically all about business, and everyone that goes there knows this. So the interesting thing is that the way LinkedIn is put together, it's made so that you could go there, you could find a person. So say we're looking for Dave Matthews Band. We would put Dave Matthews Band in a search there on LinkedIn. It's going to show you, you know, anyone who's possibly in your network that is either working at Dave Matthews Band or has a contact there or something to that effect. Now, the way it works is you can literally message that person from LinkedIn if you want to. If you're connected with them through a group, sometimes you can just message them and that'll be fine. Or if, you know, you have some type of other, like, you know, open connection or friend of a friend or something, sometimes you can message them that way. Otherwise, LinkedIn actually has, like, upgrade features, and then you have to, you know, pay, basically, to be able to contact the specific person, you know, and you have to go through this whole kind of rigmarole to get to that person. That's how it's supposed to work. That's not how I use it. So taking a page from the, you know, the folks at the chopping block, you know, at the beginning of my career, I always looked at how I could hack these processes. So the great thing about LinkedIn is that when you go there and you have an account, definitely connect with, you know, as many people as you can, because that makes your entire network bigger and that makes your search queries more valid. So, you know, you're going to get good searches back, basically. So once I have a name of someone in LinkedIn that I want to be working with, I then take that name, because you'll get the first and the last name, and then go to Google. And instead of Google is where I actually look and get all of their contact info. Because it's amazing how much info you can get from someone just from Google. And if you haven't, you know, definitely take the time and, you know, do a vanity search on yourself. You know, take your full name, Google, search yourself, and I'm sure you'll find some things that you completely forgot that you ever posted, maybe at a forum or something. But you also find, you know, a lot of relevant things. And this is the same exact thing that I do with any client I'm looking to work with. So if we found a specific contact there, I would take that name, go to Google, and lo and behold, chances are I'm going to find a lot of different information from them. I'm going to find information from conferences they might have gone to, where, you know, a lot of conferences these days actually, you know, print out or put on their website all the attendees that are coming. You know, so I might see, you know, different conferences that they're going to or will be going to, which is even cooler. I'm able to go ahead and see, you know, if they have a personal blog or something like that. If they have a Facebook account, that'll come up. If they have a Twitter feed, if they have something along those lines, that'll come up as well. And if you're not familiar with Twitter, it's all the rage since Oprah talked about it. But Twitter's actually, you know, a great resource. And, you know, I know it can be incredibly confusing at first, but the thing about Twitter and about Facebook is that both of them break down the barriers of, you know, kind of, I would say the barriers of the business world. You know, I'm finding it easier and easier to connect with people you never thought you'd be able to get just by connecting with them through Twitter or through Facebook and literally messaging them on there. And, you know, they'll message you back and, you know, you'll have an actual meeting with them the next week or a phone call with them, you know, within days. So Twitter and Facebook, you know, even if you aren't paying attention to them now, you definitely are going to want to. They're not fads. It's not something like that. They're definitely things that, you know, are going to increase the potential, basically, of how close you can get to these contacts. So, that, you know, that's how I kind of use LinkedIn to get closer to these specific clients. Now, the other thing I would suggest to you for this is looking at, you know, kind of blanketing all of this contact, meaning that, you know, and this is true from the advertising and marketing world, you know, doing one really, really good point of contact with somebody isn't necessarily always, doesn't necessarily work as well as having multiple points of contact with them. Meaning that if my company, Core Industries, went ahead and sponsored an event, you know, that's one point of contact. So say, for example, I know the person I want to get in touch with is going to a conference, and I know what the conference is. So I might sponsor that conference specifically so that they see our logo around, you know, the place when they're at the conference or when they're going to the cocktail hour or whatever it may be. Another point of contact might be I might actually, you know, find a friend that knows someone there and have them mention to that person or mention to that person's department or send an intercompany email, you know, explaining what my company is and what we do. So that's another point of contact. I might also, and I shouldn't say might because these are all things I do. So I'll also, you know, make it kind of a planned effort so that we meet up somewhere, whether it's at a networking event or the conference or, you know, maybe we happen to be, good case is that, you know, in New York and a lot of metropolitan areas, we always have different parties or, you know, different types of cocktail things that are going on. So I'll usually make it a habit to go to these, to specifically look out for, you know, some folks that I'm trying to work with. And then another point of contact I would do is basically the cold call, you know, is that at that point, you know, when I feel like they may have been warmed up to all these things, seeing me in all these different touch points, then that cold call makes so much more sense. Because, you know, even though they might say, you know, they're not really familiar with what we do, you know, once you kind of show them your logo or your site or your work or whatever they've, you know, been seeing as the touch point, that'll jog their memory. And it'll definitely go over much smoother. Now, the last thing I would say in order to contact a client like this is to make sure, or actually to use to your full advantage, any specific referrals that you can get. And that's always going to be kind of the best way to go. So if you did have a client that may have met this person already, or if you had a friend that, you know, specifically knows this person you're trying to get in touch with, or, you know, if you, you know, may have met an acquaintance or something that might know someone, you know, this specific person there. You know, those are all great ways to get a specific referral. And what I mean by specific referral is literally have them send an email that introduces you to each other, and you're both, you know, CC'd on it. That's really what the referral is. So then it's kind of like the way that no one can duck out. You know, so many times when we get emails, you know, how long does it take you to actually answer your email? You know, it all depends kind of on what I'm doing at that moment in time. So sometimes I'll answer people back, you know, within seconds, and they're always kind of like, whoa, you know, what's going on? Why'd you email me back so quick? And other times it'll take me days or, you know, weeks because, you know, it just falls by the wayside. We forget about it. But, you know, now think about getting an email that actually has a subject that says, you know, Dan, meet Tracy, Tracy, meet Dan. Chances are you're actually going to open that. You're going to say something back because now you feel obligated. And this is the same thing that happens with the client. So if you can get those types of referrals, totally awesome. It's actually one of the best things that you can do. So that's it for the client wish list. If you have any questions, feel free to unmute and ask. Otherwise, we'll keep moving on. You can ask questions anytime.
I've got a quick one, Daniel.
Yeah.
So would you suggest then, rather than making, you know, the dreaded cold call first, kind of try to do your bunch of contacts, your bunch of touch points? You think that would
work for sure,
better,
for sure.
Or even if you didn't, you know, even if you're just kind of seeing them around at a conference,
yeah,
or you didn't really talk to them?
Oh, definitely.
So, yeah, okay.
I mean, I only mentioned cold call first today just because that's the one that, you know, we all have the ability to do no matter what.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, the touch points and the referral stuff is actually, you know, some of the best stuff you can get into to engage them. Also, too, if you're going to meet them at a conference or something or some type of event, it's usually a lot easier to get introduced to those folks than you would think. The funny thing is that usually when I go to something, I don't necessarily just – I don't usually go as just a participant, so usually I'll go and I'll either be speaking at it or I'll make it a conscious effort to help out the organizers in some way. And I don't mean volunteering, but I mean, like, you know, coming early to help them set up a little bit or, you know, staying later to help them put stuff away. Because what happens is the people who run the event will completely remember you for the future. So every event you go to after that, they will be more than happy to introduce you to someone. And that person that runs the event is going to know practically everyone at the, you know, at it. So it works just tremendous wonders. And, you know, it's about being genuine, too. You know, at the end of the day, we all feel good when we help someone. So, you know, if you're able to help them do this stuff, you know, that's pretty awesome.
That's cool. Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Daniel?
Yeah.
This is Jenny. I have a question, kind of follow-up from the previous caller. Instead of cold calling first, what about if I send, I'm an illustrator, send samples of the appropriate samples to a prospective client, wait, let's say, 7 to 10 days, you know, give them some time to receive the package and hopefully take the opportunity to look through it, the samples, and then follow up with a call?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of like the traditional way of doing things. It does work. It all depends really on who you're going after and how much time, how much time they're actually going to have to look at it. Because here's the thing. So if you send the work, and I just know from my experience too, so like as like a general manager of a studio, like if someone sends me their illustration work, I'll either look at it right then or I won't look at it again. Do you know what I mean? So I may make a note to come back to it and look at it later, but I won't just because so many other things happen in that period of time that I end up forgetting about it. And don't let that discourage you, though, because the key thing is that, you know, you just need to make it memorable in some way to them.
So when I call them,
right?
Yeah, and remind them that I send a package a week ago or 10 days ago, with, you know, most people will then just go and look for the package and then look at it, you know?
Sure. So do you usually send it through the mail or email or?
Well, usually I send it by email, but I'm going to do it by mail. I'm going to send printed samples to this prospect, and wait 7 to 10 days and follow up with a call. Someone recommended that to me.
Yeah. 7 to 10 days almost seems too long to me. I mean, 3 to 5 sounds about right.
3 to 5? Okay.
7 to 10 is like, you know, that feels like a month to me. You know what I mean?
But
it feels so long.
Yeah. But sometimes
I would agree with that as an owner of a studio, too. That if I get photography mailers or illustration mailers, 7 to 10 days, I just won't remember it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And it's not just the work at all.
Yeah, what wouldn't work at all?
It's not to diss the work at all. Like it's not because, you know, your work is mesmerizing. It's just, you know, there's so many other things that happen.
Oh, yes, I understand. But I thought it takes like two to three days, you know, for a package to arrive, you know, not a regular first class letter.
Oh, sure,
letter.
Sure.
Yeah, so then, you know, factoring that in 2 to 3 days to arrive and...
Well, what's, you know, I mean, the key thing is you have to somehow, we're not really talking about this on this call, but, you know, there's a whole other thing I do with students about, you know, what's their brand and who are they, you know, what is your company, like, what are you selling? Because, you know, if an illustrator sends me something, actually, I know the exact illustrators that have sent me stuff and I've worked with are all ones that sent me something that, you know, got ingrained into my head. So some ideas, I mean, some specific ones, I mean, some are out there, some are not so far out there. One illustrator I worked with specifically came to our office, actually walked in, you know, the front door, like, you know, met the secretary and things like that, and actually brought us, I think it was like cupcakes or something like that. I mean, it was something real cheesy. But the funniest thing was that at the bottom of the cupcakes were all of his illustrations. So, like, as we got started getting through the cupcakes in this box, we noticed, like, this, you know, array of colors at the bottom of the box. And what he had literally done is he had gotten boxes that had his illustrations literally, you know, put on the bottom of the inside of the box. So he just went, bought the cupcakes, put them in the box, gave them to us, and, you know, boom. And it wasn't just because it was an ingenious idea. It was that, you know, we're staring at these cupcakes in, you know, in this box for, you know, a good half hour while we're all sitting at the table. You know, they probably sat there for a week. And so every single person saw his illustrations basically going through there.
And you know, kind of worked, right?
Yeah, yeah. So there's things like that. I mean, and you don't want to get too cheesy or gimmicky about it, but at the same time, like, it's got to be something that's memorable to that client. Another specific thing that I know this illustrator did out of Brooklyn here was she came in. Actually, she didn't come into the studio. She took a look at the portfolio of the place I was at the time and looked at the websites we did. And she sent us I think it was just a vector illustration she made, like an illustrator or something. She sent us vector illustrations, but they were stylized to look like they were almost like charcoal in a way or something. It was really, really, it was amazingly done. But some of the illustrations she created were actually, you know, mock-ups of the sites that were in our portfolio. So essentially she kind of, like, you know, took this whole thing of, you know, these designs we did for websites and put it into a different perspective for us. And she sent it to us as, like, little poster boards, you know, things that we could basically hang up in the studio. And they were up in the studio. I don't know if they'd still be there, but, you know, they were there for a while. So, you know, yes, it takes a lot of effort for something like that. But, again, it's one of those things where if you do that, you know, it completely separates you from anyone else who's sending something like that. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard. There's no exact answer on how to you know, make yourself distinguished.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But that's another viable way of...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of making a proposal of...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and, you know, the thing is, she wasn't even showing us her work. It was more, she was just, you know, I think the whole premise was she was saying, you know, I like what you guys do, and, you know, I was making some illustrations, and I thought, you know, you guys would like to hang these up.
Mm-hmm. But you'll remember her.
Yeah, exactly, and that was the effect of it.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yep.
Okay.
Any other questions about the client wish list? So let me move on to the proposal ingredients here. So proposals is another big, you know, thing that as creatives usually get us tripped up a little bit. I know one of the things that I always wanted to know when I was, you know, really starting out doing proposals was I wanted to know what everyone else was putting in their proposals. You know, not doing corporate espionage or anything like that, but, you know, we all want to know what does the other person have in their proposal, you know, or what makes a winning proposal, what are the sections and stuff like that. So what I've seen from, you know, the different proposals I've put together at different places, from the conversations I've had with other business managers and business developers, and also just from, you know, being around the block a bit on writing these proposals, these ingredients are all kind of like the main things that, you know, you should probably have in your proposal, with the exception of some of the last things that you'll see on page 2 here. So definitely have a cover page. Usually that goes without saying, but, you know, it's extremely important that it looks professional. It's not to say that cover page might not be well designed. I have put illustrations on my cover page before, meaning like an entire illustration on the cover page, you know, that says a hand-drawn illustration that says, you know, who the client is, who we are, the date, all that stuff. You know, putting a lot of thought into it. So, you know, it's very creative when they're looking at a stack of proposals on their, you know, table. You know, it pops right out to them. I've also made it so that, you know, I've done cover pages where literally it's just, you know, a logo and, you know, the text. So, you know, it does run the gamut. And the key thing is just kind of figure out when you should be, you know, going over the top with the proposal or when it should just be something, you know, that's just kind of bare bones and get to the meat and potatoes. Definitely make sure you have contact information in their proposal. Can't tell you how many times I've gone into studios to help them with their proposal writing, and I look at the proposals they've been sending out in the past, and they didn't have, you know, specifically who they'd be working with on the projects, on your team on the project. They didn't have, you know, who they should contact with more questions or set up, you know, maybe an interview or a meeting with if they like the proposal. You know, all those things basically were kind of missing from some of these proposals I've seen. The other thing you want to make sure, too, is that you have the right contact information for the participants at the client's side. And that goes also with the next thing of stakeholders. You know, you want to kind of know everyone who's involved in the project on the client side, whether it be, you know, maybe like a creative director you're working with or a marketing manager or, you know, maybe all the way up to like a VP or something like that. And you want to be able to kind of at least have their contact info, email address, maybe phone number, things like that. Well, definitely phone number. What I would say, too, is you also want to know who is going to be spearheading the project on both sides. You know, in most cases, we'll call them a project manager. So you want to know who the project manager is going to be on the client side and who's going to be taking care of that on your side. Now, if you're a freelancer, you know, this is even more important because usually what happens is we forget to put any of this information in there as freelancers. You know, we don't usually put we'll forget our contact information or we'll forget to say that, oh, well, we'll be running the project or whatever the case may be. What I've seen in the past, it's always best to just be transparent that you are a freelancer or that you are a small studio rather than trying to bulk yourself up or, you know, say that, you know, it's like having a phone line and you answer the phone and, hello, it's Dan Industries. That's who's calling, and then, you know, you take the call, and then oh, I'll transfer you to Dan. And then you just pick up the phone and say, hi, I'm Dan. I mean, there's a whole thing you could do with making your company sound larger than it is. But in most cases, transparency is going to be the best way to go. Because if people find out, you know, halfway through the project that, you know, you don't have 4 people working on this, or you're doing the project management, and you're doing the design, and you're, you know, doing the illustrations for this, you know, then it's either going to come over really well, or it's going to come over really bad. So you always want to kind of err on the side of it coming over well. So I would always be transparent right up front. Another key thing we put in the proposal is scope. And, you know, the last thing we're going to look at here is a project scope worksheet. And, you know, some of those things will be defined through that. You know, the scope is basically looking at what is the client's problem specifically, you know, and kind of explaining, like, what their history is as a company, how they got to the problem, and looking at, you know, well, what are the kind of objectives that they need to be working with to kind of overcome this problem. So the next part also is objectives. Now, the interesting thing about objectives, and I'll explain this more with the project scope worksheet, is that the client will give you a list of objectives, usually. I would say 99% of the time. But that doesn't always mean those are the right objectives, which can be a little tricky. So there's always guesswork that we have to be doing. You know, there's kind of like a Sherlock Holmes moment where you kind of have to put on your thinking cap and say, well, is this really what they're trying to achieve, or is there something else that, you know, I really should be focusing on that they wanted to achieve? And those are the things that you would outline in the proposal. You know, what are the objectives you think that they should be focusing on? And I've even gone so far as to actually say that sometimes in proposals, being very blunt, you know, saying, like, these are the objectives that you've outlined for us, but we think, you know, you also should be focusing attention on these other objectives. And, you know, that's actually gone over rather well because you're being honest with them up front. But the other key thing is, you know, it's not much about honesty. It's not even if you got the objectives right, which sounds crazy, but, you know, it's not even so much you got the objectives right. It's that by doing that, you're showing them that you just concentrated a lot of your time on their problem. So, you know, even if you clearly missed the mark, they're excited that you've actually, you know, given them some attention, that you've focused your time on them, and you haven't even gotten paid yet, you know, basically. So that's always a very, very, very cool thing. Target audience is also another thing that I would say, you know, to look for. You know, in most creative disciplines, we have some target audience we're looking for, or we're looking to get a rise out of, or get, you know, some type of call to action from. So defining that is really key as well. You know, who does this specific speak to, or, you know, what demographic is this illustration really going to, you know, appease and get excited about? So that's what we mean by target audience. Now, the next part of the proposal ingredients, the deliverables, are a little bit different from everything else on here. Deliverables meaning that, you know, we could literally say exactly what the client is going to get from us once the project is all completed. These are usually the tangible things. So deliverables in the way of, you know, if I was doing a poster design, the deliverables might be, you know, 4,000 copies of, you know, a movie-sized poster or something like that. And I might be that kind of broad in my statement to it, because we don't necessarily know the size yet of what the poster should be. We don't necessarily know yet how many colors the poster would be. We don't necessarily know, well, we know the amount, you know, that we'd want to make, but maybe we didn't know the amount, so we just say, you know, a movie poster basically would end up being the deliverable for some of that stuff. The reason we define these deliverables is these are really, the real purpose is so that on each side we know what the client's getting, but also we do it in the reverse as well. So we also say, what are the client deliverables in this project? And that might be, you know, the client has to hand over if you're doing illustrations, the client has to hand over reference imagery, you know, that you're supposed to use. Or, you know, if you're doing a website, they have to hand over, you know, the pre-used code or the current website, or maybe they have to give you the logo in the EPS format, or whatever the case may be. And the whole point is so that, you know, once the project gets started, it's not, you know, new news, it's no amazing discovery on either of the parties' sides as to what they're supposed to be delivering at the end of the day. The next part, process. So a really key thing to have inside of every proposal, no matter what, is your process. You know, not every studio, not every freelancer works the same necessarily. I mean, a lot of us work very similar to one another, but the process is something that you can use to kind of differentiate yourself sometimes at the end of the day. I know some illustrators that actually come in and work on site for the duration of a project. And I know, you know, some specific studios that do what's called iterative design, or sorry, not iterative design, agile design, meaning that, you know, they basically work with a client over a long period of time, and this is their process. They work with a client over a long period of time, maybe 6 months to a year, to finalize something like a website or an advertising campaign or something of that nature. And basically they're making small changes all along the way with the client based on user feedback and user research of, you know, what's working, what's not working. So, you know, the process is something that we do want to define right there in the proposal, because it's going to help to, you know, not just differentiate in those aspects like I just mentioned, but it's also going to help you kind of set the rules of engagement, you know, that are going to happen along the way. Meaning, you know, how is feedback going to be given? You know, should they be giving you feedback, you know, kind of like a shotgun method, like anyone sending you emails about feedback, or should, you know, it be coming from one person on their side, all the way to, you know, how will revisions be handled? How many revisions would they get? You know, all those different pieces to the puzzle there. The next thing is milestone schedule. And for the milestone schedule, you know, what we're really looking at is, I would say, you know, not too specific at the end of the day for the dates that you would give. So I wouldn't necessarily say, you know, June 1st will be the kickoff meeting or anything like that. Instead, I would say something to the effect of, like, you know, week one kickoff meeting, or week two, you know, present homepage design, you know, something like that. The reason I wouldn't give exact dates is because you don't necessarily know when the client's going to get sign-off, you don't know when you're going to get your first check, all those kinds of things that kind of come into play, you know, that would mean that you have to go back in this proposal, change the date, and stuff like that. But the bigger reason is that the minute you put numbers in front of a client, whether they be dates or whether they be money, the minute you put numbers in front of a client, those are the numbers that they're going to fixate on for the rest of the project. And that's the honest truth. So if I was to say to them, we're going to start this on June 1st, but, you know, for some reason, you know, unbeknownst to me or completely out of my control, we can't start it on June 1st. Maybe it was something that happened on the client side. You know, maybe I said it start on June 1st, ends on June 30th, okay? So completely out of my control, can't start on June 1st. We start it maybe June 5th. When is the client going to want it to be completed? It's still going to be June 30th. So, you know, that's why we make sure we're kind of not putting specific dates inside of their specific numbers in general. The things I would throw into that milestone schedule is, you know, try to be as complete as you can. You know, things like, when's the kickoff meeting going to be? When are presentations going to take place, you know, for different designs or whatever? When are reviews going to be done? When do they need to be done by? When, you know, how long do you think it's going to take for the entire project? When's your project sign-off? And the other thing I would add to that is that at the very end, you should have what's called a project review. And it's interesting because ad agencies actually call it a post-mortem. And, you know, post-mortem in any other language usually means like an autopsy or something. And it's not that the project died, but it's more that, you know, you're looking at, well, what worked, what didn't work, trying to figure those things out with the client. But also a really, really exciting part to it is that, you know, in that post-mortem, in that review meeting, you're literally looking at what are the next steps in working with this client. You know, what are the things that we wanted to achieve in this that maybe we didn't yet, or what are the things that may have come up along the way throughout the project that we, you know, now want to go ahead and help you with, you know, because they're maybe, you know, too much for us to handle before and stuff like that. So it's always good to have a review at the very end of your project. On page 2 here, we also want to define the payment schedule. And I would actually usually put that right in line with the milestone schedule, so either on the same page or, you know, the same vicinity basically in the proposal. And again, it's going to say, you know, like kickoff meeting, first payment, you know, maybe you know, second design presentation, second payment, or, you know, something along those lines. Generally, I've seen project payments broken up into either thirds or quarters. It's usually based on the size of the project and duration of the project. You know, and there's a project that's literally, you know, over a weekend type of thing, you know, usually you just get the check on delivery and that's about it. But if it's, you know, say a month-long project, I've seen it separated into halves or thirds. And then if it's a multi-month project, that's where you see thirds or quarters that happen. We also want to put fees in there as well, so listing all the fees that are associated with that specific project. And there's a few different ways you can break it down. There's actually a whole lesson plan that I do on fees and how we break them down. And the basic ones, and some of these are probably very familiar to you, sometimes we'll break it down by the role. So we'll say, it'll take $2,500 for this illustration, it'll be $5,000 for the homepage, it'll be $2,000 for, this poster design. That's by, the actual kind of roles that are happening, or you can also say by the deliverables that are happening. Other times, we'll say it's based on the phase. So sometimes people say, the discovery phase would take, $1,500, the design phase or the illustration phase would take $4,000, the delivery phase would take $2,000. The whole idea of phases is a very popular thing, especially with interactive and web and stuff like that. It's not something I would actually recommend to too many folks. The reason being that, what happens when someone wants to cut out a phase? because the client never actually wants to pay what you're saying, so they have to cut something out. So what happens when they have to cut out a phase? What phase are they going to cut out? Chances are they're going to cut out the discovery phase. And as all of us know, if you don't do a discovery phase to kind of figure out what's going on and what the problem is and how you're going to solve it, then you can't have the other phases. So it doesn't always work out too well to put those phases right up there. I've even done it where, I've said to them kind of in big red letters, discovery phase cannot be removed. But, still, it'll be, how do we make that discovery phase smaller? So, I find that roles is really great, or deliverables is really great, defining what exactly people are getting. Some people also refer to it as kind of like a Chinese menu or something. They see what they get, basically, and they can pick and choose from that. The other thing I would say about fees is, if you have one large flat fee, like if you just said the campaign illustrations will be $25,000, it's hard to work. Usually it'll be okay to send it like that, but, at the end of the day, it's mostly better to break it down. Like if you could say, campaign illustrations will be $25,000 and then show, the first illustration that's of, a unicorn and a pony in a field will be $5,000. The second illustration that's of, a man throwing a fish will be $2,000. Like, if you can break it down like that, then even better. Because, like I said, clients are always wanting to look at, what can we do to cut costs? Maybe we didn't need everything. And that's what you want to do. You don't want them to just look at your proposal, see the $25,000, be like, forget it, they're too expensive, and, just pick someone else just based on that without even asking you. So if you break it down for them and let them know, you could kind of pick and choose and separate it from there, it's usually going to be better for you in the long run. Now, the next part here, actually, I should say these are more kind of optionals, from strategy to the last one, awards and accolades. So strategy isn't always applicable for every project we're doing. I would like to say it is, but it isn't always applicable for everything we're doing. Strategy is really the way that we're going to get from one position to another for the client, and whether that's for their brand or whether it's for some type of initiative they're trying to push forward, or whether it's to sell a certain number of products or whatever the case may be. The strategy is really defining, how we're going to do that. What's our concept, basically? And I'm not talking about doing, design comps or anything like that. Usually what we're looking at is kind of describing the method we're going to go through in the discovery phase to figure out exactly what we should be, doing at the end of the day. So in this, it's usually something that's written up that's very custom, that's specifically for this project. And the strategy is really going to hit home for them. It's going to be something that, should make them be like, oh, okay, I get it. So whereas the rest of the proposal is really just kind of, covering the bases, the strategy really gets the kind of the nugget of how you're going to actually, deploy all this stuff. How are you going to come up with your ideas? How are you going to work with them and, figure these things out? The cool thing about strategy is that if you're able to do it on, you know, different projects, the thing that ends up happening is you're seen completely different in the eyes of your client than you would be if you were just, you know, doing the production for them. If, you know, if you're just doing the design, you're just doing the illustration, you know, you're just a, you know, creative in quotes at the end of the day. But if you're also thinking about the strategy of what's going on, why are you doing the design? Why are you doing the illustration? How, what effect is it going to have on their brand? What effect is it going to have on their product or, you know, the people that they're trying to influence? That puts you in a position as being an expert in the eyes of your client. Now, if you're working with like a third party, like an agency or a marketing company or something like that, they won't always like it that you also are talking about strategy, because that's usually what they get paid for, is the ideas rather than the execution. But the cool thing is that, you know, it's very easy to explain to people that, you know, you're just focusing on the strategy of what you know and not necessarily everything about, you know, their company. You know, so if you know illustration really well, you're not necessarily going to give them strategy on how they should be making their products in the first place. You're just going to give them good, you know, good advice and on, you know, what illustrations they should be using in their catalog. You know, that's what you're going to focus on. And then a few other things here. These things really kind of give context to anyone who isn't familiar with the company. So company history, your biography, case studies, and awards and accolades. These are all really for, I would say, kind of like, you know, it's usually for the decision makers or for the executive that isn't familiar with your work, but, you know, you want them to kind of get a really quick brief synopsis of, you know, who you are, what you've done, you know, how you've done it, who you know, what kind of company you keep, and all that kind of stuff. What I would say is, you know, usually these are about a page apiece, the company history, the principal biographies, and the awards and accolades. The case studies might be a little bit longer. You might do one page that's specifically like the design or, you know, the finished product or something like that, and another page, you know, right after that design that, you know, explains what you did for them. You know, I usually always keep these four last things in proposals to anyone I'm, you know, sending it to that I don't already have a relationship with. So meaning, unless it's like, you know, a client that I'm like best friends with, you know, at that point, I usually always have, you know, company history, biographies, case studies, and awards and accolades inside of there. And the reason being is that, you know, I don't know who's going to read this at the end of the day. You know, I'm not sure who exactly the decision maker is always going to be. You know, I should, and I think I do. But, you know, you really don't know if someone's BSing you. Like maybe, you know, the marketing director said, you know, yeah, I'm making the decision, but it's actually the VP that's making the decision. The marketing director is just putting together the possible candidates to put in front of the VP. So, you know, that's why I always make sure that those four things are in there. And, you know, I think it's definitely helped in the long run. I mean, I've never been turned down for a project because someone told me my proposal was too long. You know, as much as people will complain about the length of proposals and stuff like that, you know what? Proposals aren't always meant to be read from cover to cover. They're more for being able to go through, to skim, to get the specific information that people want to get. And that's why we have these different sections to them. With that, one thing I would say is I realized I didn't have it in here. No, I didn't. Was that right after your cover page, you should actually have a table of contents page. And on that table of contents page, that's literally just telling them where everything is located inside of the proposal. Now, the length of proposals I've done, you know, anywhere from, I've done three-page proposals, not even, I think probably 2 pages I've gotten proposals down to actually doing things that are more like, I think my biggest proposal was actually like 180 pages. And it was a special print job I had to do at Kinko's, and it was actually for a government project. But I would say the median for proposal length is anywhere, you know, in a smaller studio, it's usually around like, say like 8 to like 25 pages, somewhere around there. It's like usually about the length for a proposal. The weird thing is that, you know, as you kind of get up to larger agencies, like larger scale operations, they tend to start shying away from proposals and actually go ahead and put out decks. And a deck meaning like almost like a PowerPoint slideshow or something like that, and that's a whole another conversation. And there's a whole other way that they present the same types of information here and stuff. But what I would say at the end of the day is that, you know, it's always best to give this information as succinctly as possible. You know, don't go into making it sound like a Shakespearean play or something. You know, give it to them in plain English. Tell them exactly what you're going to give them, what you're doing, all that stuff. There's a great book that I would suggest to anyone read that does proposals. It is called, I just forgot the name of it. I'll look it up and I'll have it for you guys in a sec. But so that's it about proposal ingredients. Any specific questions for those?
Yeah, I had something back
sure.
on your project review section.
Yeah.
So after everything's done, I guess you're taking an optimistic approach of it. I always thought that was the time for the client to tell you exactly what went wrong. But you see it as kind of a different, almost like a business opportunity,
sure.
It sounded like.
Because you know what happens throughout the project is you have scope creep. And for those that don't know, scope creep
yeah.
basically means you have your project scope that was set in this proposal. And then as you go through the project, you know, they want to add on different things, or they want you to create a different deliverable or something like that. So all of those things, instead of giving them those pieces of scope creep, you leave those for the very end. And that's where you say, okay, we know you wanted to do this. We couldn't get to it, but, you know, how does this relate to what we just did, and could we do that now, and how do we figure that out? And, you know, so everything kind of ties into another in a way.
Right. Oh.
And that's where I always see it, you know, leading into other projects. You know, and
that's
it's
an approach.
Yeah, and it's about being genuine too. I mean, I can't say that enough. It really is about being genuine. You know, you don't want to be like a used car salesman, being like,
right.
we can give it to you before, but we can give it to you now at that low price. Of, but it's really about being genuine. You know, if you liked working with them, then yeah, go through it and say like, hey, you know, we know you wanted this stuff. We were total asses. We're sorry we didn't give it to you. But, you know, this is the time when we can do it for you because now we can concentrate on it. We have our team that can be able to do this. You know, and if you don't like them, then you don't have that conversation. You know,
right.
Just got to move on from there. The book that I was going to recommend, I just found it here. It's Why Business People Speak Like Idiots. So Why Business People Speak Like Idiots. And I believe it's actually called Fight the Bullshit, I think is what it's called. But they don't put it on Amazon that way, so it's Why Business People Speak Like Idiots. It's an absolutely phenomenal book. You will never write a press release or proposal the same way again. And I guarantee you'll start being able to really get to kind of the, you know, get to the nitty-gritty of conversations with clients. You know, you don't have the stumbling or, you know, trying to figure out your words to talk to them and stuff like that. Because really what it does is that book explains, you know, we're all human. Why do we speak differently when we go to work than when, you know, we're in a normal setting? And that if you went to any executive club, like when I'm going to the conferences, I go to the executive clubs, no one's speaking like we do when we write a proposal. So why would we do that, you know, when we're actually writing them? And the truth is, you know, no one pays attention when we write that way either. So that's the very cool thing about it. And they give plenty of examples on why, you know, why it works and all that stuff. So it's a really, really great book. Any other questions about proposals? Okay. The last worksheet was the project scope worksheet. And I actually leave this for last just because there's so much to it that obviously we won't be going over all of it. But I do want to highlight the different sections and a few key things that I find very useful in it. So the project scope worksheet, the way it came into existence was, you know, I hate to say it, I thought I would have learned my lesson quicker, but through years of, you know, taking projects on and not being able to really assess the projects the way I needed to assess them at the very beginning, I realized I had to have something that I would go through that would be kind of a checklist to myself that would just, you know, be a whole slew of questions that basically I could define all these things, and then that would help me in the long run to be able to put my team together, to be able to write a proposal, and to be able to you know, make sure that throughout the project we're still following this, the scope that we originally spec'd out. So the first thing we look at is, what exactly the mission and objectives are. And this is something I mentioned earlier as well, was that, you know, just because they've given us a set of objectives doesn't mean that those are the actual objectives that we should be working towards. So that's something you really need to do right off the bat, is kind of get that out of them. Like, what are your objectives? Why are these your objectives? You know, and determining if those are the right objectives for the ultimate mission that they're trying to achieve. The ulterior objectives that are never said to you, but are often there, and the ones that, you know, you have to define, and you wouldn't necessarily say them back to the client, but you need to know in your own mind to be able to give them what they're looking for. Ulterior objectives might be, you know, for the client contact you're working with to get a promotion, which is honestly right up there. It's one of the higher objectives, I would say. You know, they chose the right vendor, they, you know, got this project off the ground, you know, and then you get a promotion based on that. And it's a very valid thing. Another big ulterior objective I would say is, you know, they want to make their workload easier. Often at times, you know, people are coming to us as designers, especially because there's a specific problem they're having that they need a resolution to. And that problem, you know, could be anything from, you know, the way they take contact submissions from their website to, you know, how they market their products, you know, on Main Street. And these are all things that, you know, that are taking up their time, you know, that might be pissing them off at the end of the day. So they're looking for us to actually, you know, ease that a little bit, give them more time, give them more flexibility so they can do the things that they want to do. So it's a big ulterior objective. And then there's just the whole, you know, a whole gamut of other ones that are out there. What I would say is that, you know, the way to figure those out, what I've seen, and this is actually what a good friend of mine said, was, you know, put yourself in their shoes. If I had just come to you about this project, why would I be coming to you about it? You know, what is it that I have to gain out of this, you know, from having you do the project for me? You know, it may even be that they want to prove themselves to go to another company. That's also another one I've seen a few times. You know, someone basically does something at one company and, you know, achieves a great milestone, really for the reason to become more notable in the industry, to get a better job, to go somewhere else. There's many projects I've worked on that were exactly, you know, that way. So, you know, really try to get down to what those specific objectives are in there. Now, those ulterior ones I was saying, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that to the client, but these are things that I would put down on my project scope worksheet. The project scope worksheet is just for us. It's just for us internally to know what we're dealing with. So, you know, if we think we really are making something to help them get a promotion, then that's good for us to know, because at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of different things we could do to help them get that promotion. I mean, that promotion also means more business, basically. So that's what we need to be cognizant of. The next section, logistics, on page 2. The funny thing is that most of these questions are things that we often overlook and just, you know, we always should be asking, but I think it's, you know, we either just forget or maybe we're just too embarrassed sometimes. But how quickly does the project actually need to be completed? You know, is there a specific time constraint? I can't tell you how many times someone's told me, you know, we need to have the project done by June 30th, when in fact that's just an arbitrary date that they just picked, you know, out of their heads. There's nothing really happening on July 1st. It's just June 30th sounded good. It's the end of a month. You know, so sometimes that project can actually be pushed back so that you can make the proper time for it to get it done and things like that. So you really want to get to kind of the bottom of that. You know, or other times, you know, people have said, you know, oh, we just need it sometime around, you know, sometime in the fall. When in fact, you should have had that to them by September 30th, because they have to, you know, get everything unrolled so that it can be, you know, in flyers for Thanksgiving, you know, that type of thing. So it's very important for us to kind of get to the bottom of when that project needs to be completed. How quickly can feedback be given by the client? I would typically say 48 hours to 3 days is about normal. You know, if it's a really quick project, I mean, I've had conversations with clients that literally, you know, you show them the design and they say, you know, I have to have your feedback within like 4 hours if you need it done, you know, before the weekend's over. What I would say is that, you know, don't ever let feedback go more than like a week, because that's when you see things lagging. That's when you see things, you know, really starting to go by the wayside. You know, if someone's like, oh, well, we have to take it back to our board, and you know, or I have to take it to committee, and we'll be able to get back to you, you know, in 3 weeks. Yeah. The issue with that is, it's just like I said before, even when, you know, when we're out there trying to get a hold of a client, to actually contact them, you know, if you give someone something, you know, that was 3 weeks before that, chances are they're going to forget about these things. You know, it's not something that's going to be in the forefront of their mind. And that's the issue with it, is that, you know, you want this to be something that keeps moving on. The longer a project takes for you that's on hold, the more possible money you basically are losing. Because if you didn't fill yourself with projects in between there, you're basically, you know, just sitting around twiddling your thumbs. You know, obviously, yeah, we can, you know, we can make that time of good use, we could find new clients, stuff like that. But, you know, in general, we want to get projects done as quickly as possible for the most amount of money there. Is there an established project management process that I need to follow on the client side? Very important, because you just want to make sure that you can follow whatever their project management process is. Some people just follow things like, you know, their own process. Some others follow something like Six Sigma. Six Sigma, S-I-X, Sigma, is, you know, a very defined process used by government. I think even NASA uses it and stuff like that. But that's something you want to know ahead of time, because if you're not familiar with Six Sigma, then you're going to have to send out someone to understand it, you know, to be able to go through it and really understand what goes on. How closely will the client's team be working with the designer's team? So will you need to actually be there for weekly meetings, or will there be regular status calls? At the very least, what I would say is to have a weekly status call. And the weekly status call is really, really a chance for you and the client to be on the same page on where you're at in the project, but also for everyone kind of just, you know, get together, air out anything else that's going on in that project. Are there any issues that are going on? Is there anything that needs some more attention? Is there something that's working really well that they want to do more of? That's what, you know, these weekly status calls are for. It's not a bitch fest. It's not, you know, the time to just sit around and have drinks or something like that. You know, the weekly status call is really meant to be productive. If there specifically isn't anything to talk about, which I would never believe you if you told me that, but if there's nothing to talk about, then what I would say is, you know, to use that status call for that week to think about, okay, so, you know, what's some other part to, you know, the process that we haven't, you know, really focused on yet? Because I'm sure there's something down the line. There could be, you know, how you're going to deliver, or how you're going to test, or, you know, whatever the case may be. So use it to, you know, figure out those things at that point in time. The next section, billing and compensation. So for billing and compensation, you know, we really want to get to the root of all these financial things, the things that most of us don't want to ask. I think it's, you know, I think what happens, well, I know what happens, is that we often, you know, start talking about money, and we think that the client's going to be kind of standoffish about it, you know, be like, oh, you want money for this work? But the truth is that we have to be very upfront and get this information ahead of time, because the last thing you want to be doing in the middle of a project, and especially if something's going wrong in the project, is to be tracking down a payment or trying to get a hold of the person who can write you a check. We want to know all those things ahead of time. So, like I said in the proposal ingredients, we want to define what the payment process is going to be. So, the milestone payment schedule, or sorry, the payment schedule, we want to define right ahead. We also want to know who exactly we need to send invoices to, how the invoices should be handled. I actually got halfway through a project one time, pretty large project, only to find out that they didn't take any digital invoices, meaning I couldn't send an invoice by email like I had been doing all along. Instead, I had to fax it, or I had to send it certified mail to them. They're the only client I've ever heard that's that has made me do that. But, you know, needless to say, it doesn't bode well when, you know, you're looking for a large payment to keep the studio running and all of a sudden it's not there. So had I asked these questions up front, I would have already known that I had to do those specific tasks. Is there a specific, let's see, a predefined budget for the project? Sometimes, you know, the client will have a budget set aside for it. Sometimes they won't. Here's the thing about budgets, and I go really in-depth in this, you know, just about sales in general, is that everyone has a budget in mind. You know, think about it. If you go to the store to pick up, let's say, a gallon of milk, even if you have not bought a gallon of milk before, you can kind of figure out the range of how much it's going to cost based on the price of other liquids you've had before. You know, how much is a bottle of soda? How much is, you know, a bag of chips? How much is a bottle of water? You know, so based on all of that, you can kind of say, okay, so a bottle of milk, well, I'm in New York, so there's inflation big time. So a bottle of milk maybe, you know, is going to be about $3 or something like that, $3.50, $3.99. Even if I had never seen how much a bottle of milk is. That's the same thing that clients do with us. They already have a budget in their minds, whether they've been given one or not. They already kind of know the numbers of what they're thinking. Every client will tell you, no, 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 they don't know. And, you know, I don't necessarily think it's our job really to always get it out of them. There's some sales, kind of sales gurus and stuff that'll say, you know, you have to get a budget number, you have to get a number. But at the end of the day, I think it's, you know, more of we have to show them kind of how much it's going to cost them. If we can get that number out of them, awesome. But it's even more advantageous if we can kind of ourselves think about, well, what do we think they already believe the number might be? You know, so kind of getting that type of information is very, very important. Because it also helps us figure out, well, what do we have to concentrate on when kind of selling this to them? The next section here, stakeholders and responsibilities. So, you know, going back to the beginning of the proposal ingredients, you know, we were mentioning this over there, which was, you know, who are the stakeholders in this project? And this is just a great, you know, worksheet, basically, that page 4, to go through that and figure out who are the stakeholders on your side and who are the stakeholders on the client side. The one thing I would say is try to be as truthful as possible. I mean, you might say that the CEO of the other company is a stakeholder in this, but you know what? If they're really not going to ever be in a meeting and they're not ever going to have any input on this project, then are they really a stakeholder? Probably not. So, you know, be pretty truthful about that and who's really going to be there all the time and, you know, having a vested interest in seeing this be successful. The other thing I would say, too, is like, it's really interesting because there's also folks that would maybe not like to see it become successful. And, you know, we usually don't want to think that, but, you know, it happens. There's also people that don't want to see something succeed just basically so they can prove a point or you know, so that person doesn't get a promotion or whatever the case may be. It's also be, you know, something to be very cognizant of. I wouldn't say, you know, to fixate on it, but it also does happen. So it's also another thing that you should be aware of when identifying stakeholders. The next section is creative requirements. The first question being, will there be a creative director on the client side for the project? Which is always, I always find it to actually be a really good thing, even if that creative director, or even if that, you know, let's just say a creative in general, even if that creative isn't as knowledgeable as we are, which is to be expected. The great thing about having them on that side is that you have someone to kind of get more information out of that's probably going to be willing to give it to you. Now, I have seen the opposite of that, you know, running into a creative that maybe feels threatened because you might be doing what they had been doing. And, you know, the way to approach that is the same thing, is to include them in the process as much as possible. You know, think about it. If you're feeling threatened, you know, and all of a sudden someone, let's say you have a tree that fell down onto your yard or something, and your neighbor wants to come over and walk on your lawn to take away the tree, chances are, you know, yes, you'll be pissed off about the tree. The other thing is, you know, you won't feel so bad if they, you know, come over, chop up the tree, take it off of your property and put it back onto theirs or whatever. Now take the same scenario, because they're helping you basically. Now take the same scenario and think of that neighbor coming over to your lawn and just standing in the middle of your lawn. And chances are you're going to feel a little threatened. Doesn't matter how much you know your neighbor. Chances are you're going to be like, why is he on my lawn? What is he doing? Why is he staring? So it's the same type of thing. You know, if we can show them we're helping them in some way and get their help, then they're going to feel less threatened at the end of the day. Is there a style guide that should be used to direct the design? Good and bad, but it's definitely something we want to know. Will there be original illustration, photography, or animation used for this project? You know, this, I would say this more relates to just general graphic design. You know, when we're putting together designs, what elements do we need, and do we need to find another vendor, basically, to work with us? So do we need another, you know, creative and illustrator to work with us, or a photographer, or an animation studio, or something like that to help us on this project? If there's printing, who will handle the printer and hand off the files? You know, a huge part of most projects is the printing process, and who's going to deal with that? Will that be the client? Will that be you? I've seen so many times where print jobs have gone bad just because that was just kind of left up to chance. The question wasn't asked, and you would say that's, you know, one of the biggest questions when you're doing something like that. But, you know, the reality is it's something we want to get out of the way really early in the process. Is there a specific number of revisions the client would like for each round? Now, I've seen this go both ways. Generally, the standard I've seen is 2 to 3 rounds of revisions. So it's 2 to 3 rounds of revisions for design, for illustration, all kinds of things like that. And it's usually, you know, it's based on a fixed price. So, you know, you say $2,000 gets you, you know, this design and 2 rounds of revisions. But I've also seen the opposite of that. I've seen where people say, okay, $2,000 gets you this, you know, design, and then any revisions after that are based on hourly. So I've seen that as well. And then I've also seen the process of saying, you know, that basically everything is hourly. There is no, you know, fixed price, and revisions are all based on hourly, so you can have as many revisions as you want, which also, you know, sometimes happens. The one thing I would say to steer away from, no matter how good it sounds for business, is to give a fixed price and give an unlimited number of revisions. The reasoning that that doesn't work, and you can try it a few times. I mean, I have seen it work sometimes, but it, you know, it just takes one or two clients to really take advantage of it, and then it just absolutely spoils it for everyone else. So, you know, you'll go way beyond 2 or 3 revisions and end up with, you know, 40 to 50 revisions on a project that ends up taking, you know, 4 months more than it probably should have. And I've seen it happen a few times now. So, you know, I've really found that when you kind of sit, when you document exactly how many number of revisions someone's going to get, it helps ease that revision decision at the end of the day. The cost-benefit analysis is the next page. Now, the cost-benefit analysis is really important when we're kind of looking at the onset of a project and whether we want to take it on or not. What I would say is that, you know, we really have to look at every project on a case-by-case basis, because not necessarily would you want to take on something that isn't within your realm of expertise, or is maybe going to make you work late nights, or, you know, it's maybe going to be against your own ethics. All those things, you know, would be costs and benefits of a project. So when you're looking at the costs, you know, what are your costs? Not just financial, but, you know, emotional. What are your professional costs? What are your ethical costs? You know, what are all those different aspects? So say you're going to take on a project for Philip Morris. You know, I'm actually a former smoker, so I actually would never take on a cigarette project. I don't even take on alcohol projects either. But, you know, that's part of my own ethical costs. You know, I would never put my ethics on here as, you know, one of the things and say that, yes, it's okay, you can, I'll do it for you for, you know, gobs of money or whatever. So the truth is that, you know, we really need to kind of weigh these costs and benefits at the end of the day. Now, when you're looking at the costs and benefits for the client, that's a little bit more trickier. So what you really have to look at, you know, is what are their costs, meaning, you know, is it going to take them, does it mean they're not going to be able to release their product on time, or does it mean that they're all going to have to work late hours and be stressed out? But, you know, for benefits, we go back to that whole thing I was saying earlier, which was, you know, is this going to get someone a promotion, or is this going to increase their sales, or, you know, all those different aspects. And so that's what we're looking at. Really, this page, the cost-benefit analysis, is to help us get an understanding of, is this a project we want to take on, and also, you know, divulge kind of some of the hidden things that are going on and whether it's going to be a good project for us. And the second to last page here is the proposal process. So some of the questions we'll want to know before putting that, together that proposal is there a specific process that needs to be followed in submitting the proposal? So does it have to, you know, do we have to first send a letter of intent and then write a proposal? Do we have to make it a certain number of pages? You know, does it have to be faxed and, you know, sent through email or whatever the case may be? Are there other creative studios bidding on this project? If so, who? The interesting thing is that, you know, I've gone to a lot of presentations and actually walked past our competition. And, you know, we know each other, too, in the industry. So the funny thing is that if you end up going to a presentation type of thing, it pays to go a little bit early, like a half hour early, maybe 45 minutes early, because chances are they probably booked a bunch of meetings that day to go over, you know, to meet with people, you know, that they liked or whatever. So if you get there a little early, you might actually see your competition leaving right before you go in, which is always very interesting. What items are expected to be contained in the proposal? So we have those proposal ingredients. So, you know, just looking at that, there's specific things that aren't in those proposal ingredients. When is the proposal due? How should it be submitted? Who should it be sent to? And what is the decision-making criteria that'll be used to award the project? And the funny thing is you would normally think the criteria is going to be based on budget, but it's not always. It's usually based on, you know, a host of different things. And it's something that if we know that ahead of time, we can also kind of, you know, cater that proposal to hint on those pieces, to kind of subtly, you know, say our expertise in that area or, you know, show all those different aspects that we otherwise normally wouldn't put into the proposal. And the last page here is the quality triangle. And I'm not sure how many people are familiar with the quality triangle. It's funny, here in New York, it seems most designers haven't seen the quality triangle, but you know, as I go to different conferences around the U.S., a lot of people have, so I'm not sure what's different here in New York than elsewhere, but the quality triangle basically says this, and I use this actually on every client call I have about a new project. It's that it has 3 points in the triangle, cheap, fast, and good, and you can only ever have 2 of those points. If you try to have 3 of those points on a project, then the project is definitely going to fail in some aspect. So if you want something cheap and fast, it's not going to be good. If you want something good and fast, it's not going to be cheap. It's going to take a lot of money. And if you want something to be good and cheap, it's not going to be fast. And those are usually the projects that we do that are, you know, like for friends or family. Usually the projects that are on, like, the back burner, per se. The quality triangle, I literally, like, when I'm on a call with a client, I'll usually just write a quality triangle on a piece of paper with me. And I'll just make little kind of like check marks next to the different boxes of you know, what I'm hearing from the conversation with the client. You know, are they looking for it to be cheap? Are they looking for it to be fast? Are they looking for it to just be really, really good? I would say, you know, all of us try to take on projects that are going to be relatively, like, good and fast because, you know, that means we're doing high-quality stuff, we're getting it done relatively quick, so it's not going to take forever, and we're making, you know, good money on it. The trick is, and the hardest part, is doing something that's fast and cheap. And that's usually what a lot of folks will try to, you know, kind of rein us in with is, you know, do this fast and cheap project for us, and later on I'll give you a good and fast project, you know, for more money. And it's also called the dangling carrot, and that's something you'll hear a lot in the sales world. So the trick is making those fast and cheap projects good enough that we could actually show them in our portfolio, or, you know, simply just stating, I'm not going to do it on cheap, no matter what. In that case, trying to make it fast and good, no matter what. So that's the project scope worksheet. And I realize I've gone over just a few minutes here, I think about 15 minutes more. But what are the questions you guys have? Anything specific to the worksheet or anything else I've mentioned today? I know I've thrown a lot at you so far.
Hi, this is Richard with Focus Design Group.
Yeah.
I guess the one thing that I see that I'm curious about is ownership of work. And I'm in a right now with a client, actually probably breaking up with a client per se.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a very appropriate time for me both to get some new business in and to find out, you know, what my legal rights are and when they should be presented.
Right.
So.
So the whole case comes down to the contract that was signed. And the reason I actually left that out on purpose. So. A proposal is a little bit different from a contract. Proposal meaning, you know, it's still part of the sales process. So you're trying to court the client, trying to get them to work with you. The contract meaning that, you know, the contract might have some of the fundamentals that are in the proposal, like deliverables, things like that. But the contract will also have terms and conditions inside of it, and that's where you would have things like, you know, who owns the rights and all of that stuff. And that's the things that, you know, is meant for the legal teams to work out. What I would say is this. In most cases, in most areas, when someone hires a graphic designer,
yes.
The work is done at work for hire, usually what the courts will say. But I would always suggest to consult a lawyer to see exactly what it is in, like in your area, because
mm-hmm.
Every state can be a little bit different. But the other aspect of that is that if there is any mention of licensing involved or anything like that, or if there is maybe the project was stopped abruptly before the everything was completed, then that's where it's really kind of, you know, a sticky situation, and that's where it's definitely, I would say, is, you know, find someone, a legal representative to talk with for sure that can help you figure those things out. There is, believe it or not, there are lawyers out there that work pro bono or work very low cost specifically for creatives. What I would say is start with this. It's VLANY.org. It's
NY is in New York?
Yeah, NY is in New York. It's Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts.
Okay.
So it's V as in Vicky, L as in Lance, A as in Alpha. NY, N as in Nick, Y as in your, VLANY.org. And I believe they only work with people who commute into New York City, but VLA is a national organization. And I, as far as I know, they are set up in most states, or at least they have some type of like partnerships with other similar types of organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And they're great folks to work with. I actually worked with them a long time when I was a freelancer. And most of them have these clinics, so like I believe it's usually once a month where basically you come in, you pay $20, and you get to sit down with a lawyer for an hour and a half, and just show them anything. Contracts, you can have them, you know, look over court papers, you can have them look over your mortgage, like whatever it is, because it's all for creatives, you know. It's
right, yeah,
based on our,
yeah. My problem is I'm in a non-metropolitan area, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, so the closest... There is one in Philadelphia, but that's a 2-hour drive on a good day.
Sure. Well, they'll also do via email and phone as well.
Okay.
Yeah, they definitely will. And Harrisburg, I grew up in Binghamton, New York, so I know exactly where Harrisburg is. And you know, they'll definitely do phone and email. I mean, that's a good one. It becomes an incredible importance once you start getting to that issue of who owns what. It's where you have to get a lawyer involved. You know.
Yeah, and I don't want to waste a lot of time because I know it's kind of off topic. You know, I met with an attorney this week, but we were working without a contract, which has really created, and it's been a longstanding client, and it's just gotten dysfunctional would be a nice way to put it.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, I will try that out and see if maybe I can get some other advice there. Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions? All right, Jackie, anything else you wanted to mention? No? All right, well, thank you all. Thank you all so much, and hope you enjoyed it. And if you have any other questions that come up, feel free to email me, too. My email address is Daniel, D-A-N-I-E-L, at Schutzmith, it's SCHUTZSMITH.com. And I'll answer your questions as best I can, as quickly as I can. So I hope you guys enjoyed that, and take care. Best of luck in business.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.